Our next session, we're going to hear from Dr. Marvin Schick, who is a musmach of Rabbi Jacob Joseph School, a fellow alumni, and holds a doctorate from New York University in political science. He taught at a number of universities in New York. He's the author of a work on Learned Hands Court, and he served as administrative assistant to Mayor John Lindsay in New York City, and has held a number of communal positions. He's been active in Jewish life for about 50 years, and for the past 33 years, he served as the voluntary president of Rabbi Jacob Joseph School, in which he's largely due to his efforts. The school, at least the name of the school, is still in existence, both in Edison, New Jersey, and in Staten Island. Under his sponsorship, the school publishes the Distinguished Journal of Halacha and Contemporary Society, and he is well known as an activist in the field of Jewish education in the wider community. And without further ado, it's my pleasure to introduce Dr. Marvin Schick, who will talk to us, Can Jewish Education Save North American Jewry?
Where did all the people go? Why did Sam take them with him? Thank you for the nice introduction. When I received the invitation to participate in this conference from Elliot Melamed, I really did not know anything about Torah in Motion, but what he presented to me sounded interesting, and so I accepted. And at the time, I had no idea that there was some controversy about Torah in Motion based on the participation a year ago of Rabbi Slifkin and some other matters. Had no idea of that. So I must say at the outset that had I known that there was such controversy and that some people think it inappropriate to participate in these conferences, I certainly would have accepted and would have participated. I say this despite the fact that there are some very unsettling things. And they touch on in terms of the subject of my talk. I listened to two talks this morning. I'm not going to go into the details, but each of them, from the standpoint of at least a part of orthodoxy, the so-called enclavist part, it's very disturbing. It's easy to mock either part of orthodoxy and get jokes from laughs from an audience, but it's not appropriate. And some other things aren't appropriate. And I say that because for 55 years, I've tried to demonstrate that the boundaries are blurred, that this notion that there are two parts of the community is only in the minds of people who want there to be such barriers. Mention was made of the Rabbi Jacob Joseph School. We have four schools. I'll only mention two of the four schools. One of them is a Black Hat Yeshiva in Edison, New Jersey. It's a Masifta, Beis Medrash, and Kollel. It's a dormitory school. The boys of college age do not go to college. Simple as that. So that's one of our schools. And we have a second school. I'll leave out the other two, which are centrist Orthodox. But we have another school, which is modern Orthodox, co-educational day school, with 420 students, with a Kiruv orientation. And it kind of demonstrates what can be accomplished in Torah education if you don't establish these barriers and boundaries, and you look at the children and the opportunity to have them grow in Torah and Judaism. But if you put up the boundaries, then there exists what is in your mind becomes real. 40 years ago, more than 40 years ago, I established a thing called Kulpa, which in the space of 5 years created a new area of law in at least the United States. It affected Canada and Israel, even in a way, the law of religious persons. A field that didn't exist, absolutely didn't exist. And this was at a time when, within Orthodoxy, the conflict was far, far greater than it is today. Very few of you who are here understand the toxic nature, if you will, of the conflict, let's say, over the Synagogue Council of America, the division over it, the division over the Issa promulgated nearly 50 years ago by 11 leading Rosh Yeshiva led by Rav Aaron Kotler, who I was very close to. It's toxic. And yet, in the period of Kolpa, we prepared documents, briefs that were signed by Agudath Israel, by the Rabbinical Council of America, by the Orthodox Union. So there are possibilities in Jewish life. And the possibilities exist in Torah education and in any other area. When you refuse to make an idol out of certain categories, and that's critical. And those of us who have been fruitful, and I look at Rabbi Bravand as one, those of us who have been fruitful have been fruitful precisely because we haven't made an idol out of false boundaries. The subject given to me is can Jewish education save North American Jewry? Unfortunately, when they sent the topic to me, I wasn't paying much attention. My fault again. And so I would not have accepted something who said, can Jewish education? Because what is Jewish education? A one-day Reform Jewish Sunday school event? Or informal education, a youth group, a camping experience, an Israel experience? So I thought when I got the invitation that I was being asked to speak about day school education. In fact, that's what I'm going to speak about because I think that's the thrust of it. As far as supplementary education and informal education, I'll simply say that serendipitously other kinds of educational experiences can lead to beneficial outcomes. That's the nature of the world. Without any degree of effort to raise people in Judaism, any kind of Jewish experience can somehow trigger something within an individual, and that can lead to linkages with more meaningful Jewish experiences. But for North American Jewry to be saved, what is required is the concept of religious purposefulness. That is, what is being intended is not merely the conveyance of knowledge, but in fact the conveyance of a way of life, to inculcate children in such a fashion so that as they reach adulthood, they will simply regard it as a privilege to be a member of a community that is linked to Sinai and which will be linked to generations yet unborn. So we will talk about day schools. In North America, that is including Canada, of course, there are about 250,000 students in Jewish day schools. And we don't know for sure whether that is a greater figure than the number of students in supplementary schools. The supplementary school enrollment has declined almost steadily as a consequence of losses in Jewish life, the closing of a number of synagogues and temples around the country, and simply the impact of advanced assimilation as people who had some tenuous connection of Judaism no longer in their families have any connection with Jewish life. They don't listen to our messages. They don't care. There are people who believe that there are more than 300,000 or about 300,000 students in supplementary schools. Something that I'm connected to, the Avichai Foundation is funding a census, will be the first census of such schools, at least in the United States, comparable to the censuses of Jewish day schools that I have conducted. But whatever the number in Jewish day schools and whether it's greater or not than the number of supplementary schools, the fact of the matter is that Jewish day school enrollment has been growing up largely because of the birth rate in the two sectors of Haredi life, the Hasidic sector and the Yeshiva world sector. One of the major changes in Orthodox life in the recent period has been the fact that Yeshiva world birth fertility rates, which were not that much different than, let's say, the fertility rates in centrist Orthodoxy, have reached a point where they are approaching the numbers of the Hasidic world. 8, 10, 12 children in the Yeshiva world, which was unbelievably uncommon a generation ago, is now quite common, at least in the United States. And Israel might be a different picture. I don't know the statistics about Israel. So day school enrollment has been growing, and that's a beneficial thing. There's also a lot of new schools, not all of them geared to orthodoxy. There are a number of conservative schools, known as Salem Schechter schools. There are in the United States, at least, there are nearly 20 Reformed day schools under a regime called Pardes, and there are a growing number in Canada and the United States of community day schools. In fact, that's the, in terms of numbers of schools, that's the most rapidly growing section. So the question is whether these schools in the aggregate, but particularly the schools that are geared toward the marginally religious, toward the non-committed, to the non-Orthodox families, whether they, in fact, can make a meaningful contribution to Jewish continuity. We assume largely correctly that the Haredi schools, the Yeshiva World schools, and again the Hasidic schools, while they have some fallout because inevitably that's part of what life is about, but the fact of the matter is that the retention rate in terms of Orthodoxy is extremely high, the intermarriage rate is extremely low, and those schools certainly will do their part in saving, if that's the right term, North American Jewry. But what about the other schools? To answer the question, one has to understand what education is about. Education essentially has two thrusts, a primary thrust and a secondary thrust. The primary thrust is to teach subject matter, to, in effect, increase the knowledge of children and the skills of children, the hope, the goal being that when they reach adult life, that they'll be able to have fruitful lives. They'll go on to college and graduate schools. They'll go into the professions. They'll have certain skills that are useful in modern society. And that's the main purpose of education, that you learn subject matter, whether it's Jewish education or secular education, academic subjects. You teach being taught subject matter. And to connect with subject matter are certain cognitive skills and other skills. That is the core purpose of all educational experiences. There's a secondary function which is called socialization. Now, socialization historically has had a kind of benign thrust. You teach children the idea of authority, at least proper authority, how to respect other people, how to respect other children, not to call out, not to run out, not to act out, and do various things that are inappropriate. So there is a socialization thrust, and indeed to understand the ranking, the comparable ranking of the two thrusts of education, you have a report card. One part of the report card, which parents pull the hair about, is what they get in grades on subject matter. The other part is what they get on the other part of the report card, you know, on conduct and things like S's and U's and whatever else they get. And teachers generally try to fill it all as S's, meaning satisfactory, and unsatisfactory, either the parent ignores it, whatever else, or the kid ignores it. In fact, in some places, a kid might be a hero if he or she doesn't get all satisfactories. That's the traditional way of looking at the socialization process. But there's a more important thrust in the socialization process, both in governmental schools or ordinary elementary and secondary schools and in Jewish schools. In the ordinary schools, given what has happened in modern life, the degree of family breakdown, the extent of social pathologies, what has happened increasingly over the last 30 or 40 years is that the inability of society or social institutions such as family and home to perform certain functions, or the breakdown of family in terms of divorce and other, again, pathologies, has resulted in schools being asked to act as surrogates for processes that are not being fulfilled outside of the school. So you have, as an example, food programs, you have mental health programs, you have physical health programs. You have counseling programs of all kinds. And the idea is to simply counteract via the mechanism of the school the destructive forces that occur outside of the school, the hope being that by counteracting these destructive forces, that the school will be able to perform its primary function, which is educational. That's what happens in the general society. In the Jewish society, in the Jewish world, where social pathologies certainly do exist, because as Professor Hyland said correctly, that what happens in the outside world does seep into the Jewish world, even the Orthodox world. So there is a degree of family breakdown, a far higher incidence of divorce, for example, a far greater incidence of drug abuse. We don't have the incidence of teenage pregnancy and whatever else which you have in governmental schools, but you have serious problems. But the real thrust is to counteract, certainly in the schools that we're talking about here, the non-Orthodox, the marginally Orthodox, the schools that have a Kira function, is try to counteract the destructive Jewish forces in the general society. That is advanced assimilation. That is the defining downwards of Judaism. That is a process of Judaic abandonment, which is so corrosive and so ongoing. And the hope is that the Jewish schools will be able to counteract that. And so we now have programs that could be family education programs, counseling programs, curative programs, Shabbatonim, and a whole host of other projects and initiatives, activities, which are aimed at, again, counteracting which happens outside of the school. The hope being that the Judaic educational function will be enhanced because kids are more likely to learn subject matter and to keep it and be interested and continue in school if you can counteract what happens outside of the school. The fact of the matter is that as we've learned from, again, the general area of public education, that what is destructive in society does not stop at the school doors. It just doesn't. A kid doesn't who is destructive in some way. The child is not a functioning child in the ability to get along or to study or whatever else. That when that child is outside the school, he or she is not going to be one person outside and a separate person inside. So what schools do is essentially open the door for situations that are antithetical to the school performing their educational function, Jewish in our schools, generally in other schools, and that limits the ability of schools to perform correctly and to do what they have to do. In Jewish life, the more opening schools are to the outside world, the more they are willing to embrace what happens in the outside world, then the greater the prospect that the outside world will intrude to a point where it undermines the capacity of schools to do, with respect to Jewish education, that which we want them to do. And that's the issue which we face, whether our schools can counteract the social pathologies or the Jewish pathologies which exist in the outside world. Is our faith in day schools justified or not? As I've indicated, that day schools cover a great waterfront, a very large waterfront. There are conservative day schools, reform day schools, and community day schools, modern Orthodox day schools, Kiruv schools, Chabad, which for a very long period of time ignored, particularly throughout almost the entire life of the late Rebbe until the last years of his life, ignored the idea of developing day schools. When the Rebbe previously came to the United States, well, in North America, Chabad yeshivas opened up in many cities in North America, Detroit and Boston and Philadelphia and a whole series of places. And then they gave that up and they had the mitzvah tents, and they did supplementary education, Talmud Torahs, and whatever else. In the last years of his life, the Rebbe switched course. This is something that hasn't been written about. And he sanctioned the establishment of day schools. So Chabad day schools, the network of Chabad day schools in North America, is one of the fastest growing groups of day schools in the country. So the question is, can these schools do a job? Can they, in effect, counteract what's going on in the world? Can they allow in that which is antithetical to Judaism, at least to a certain extent, and yet perform that which we want them to perform? The news is largely not good. Although, again, either serendipitously or because there are people who come from who come to school to teach or to run a school, to participate, develop programs which have a sense of religious purposelessness, there is a measure of success. But the record right now is extremely, extremely disappointing. For one thing, this is, by the way, a development which I'm about to get to, which is less true of Canada than in the United States. The conservative movement is in a state of collapse in the United States. The numbers have gone down unbelievably. In the United States, in the past 5 years, six or seven Solomon Schechter schools, that's the name for conservative day schools, have closed, and several have, in effect, transformed themselves into community day schools. Now, if you ever went to a Solomon Schechter school, that is, either as a student or you went there because you've had some work to do there, you would see that there was a sense of religious purposelessness. It wasn't orthodoxy, but this was the more traditional wing of conservatism. And I've been to at least half of Solomon Schechter schools in North America. That has changed as the conservative movement has lost its traditional wing, either because some have split toward one orthodoxy, or more likely because people who were a part of the traditional wing, their children have moved toward reform, or at least toward the less traditional wing of conservatism, the interest in Solomon Schechter schools has declined, and so enrollment is plummeting in Solomon Schechter schools, and they're in trouble. In their place, you have community day schools, and that covers a great waterfront. A lot of different kinds of schools. There are about 120 of them in the United States, and you have one very large one in Toronto. And it's hard to generalize about community day schools, but there are some common denominators. That is, they are less traditional. They have devote fewer hours to Judaics. They devote fewer time to religious purposes than do the Solomon Schechter schools. That's a simple fact. And in fact, in the recent period, they've defined Judaism downward. There was a very large community day school in North Miami Beach. It had 1,500 students. It's down to 900. Which basically was a community day school, basically was an Orthodox day school masquerading as a community day school, Hillel School, in North Miami Beach. It's changed its character totally, for whatever reasons. You go to a community day school in Houston, which I've gone to. So you go into the sixth grade, because they start at the sixth grade. So apart from the fact they have any constitutional bylaws that they have to admit non-Jewish students equally to Jewish students, and they do admit a number of non-Jewish students, and I'll get to that issue shortly. And I talk about non-Jewish students, I do not mean that the issue of patrilineality or something like that. I mean the father's not Jewish, the mother's not Jewish, the bubba's not Jewish, the zaydis are not Jewish. That's what a non-Jewish family means in this context. So you go into that school, and they have two feeder schools. One is a reform school called the Schlenker School, and one is a Solomon Schechter School in Houston. Most of the kids in this large community day school come from from the Solomon Schechter School. In the Solomon Schechter School, all the way at the Kippot. If you go to the Solomon Schechter School, they have these Sephardic Kippot, which are very popular. You go into a Chumash class, as I did in the community school in Houston. There isn't a boy wearing a kippah. The Chumash class, not math, not English, nothing else. You go to the new community high school in San Francisco. And they tell you there are four minyanim in the morning. There is a meditation minyan. There's a musical minyan where they play the guitar or something. There is a pluralistic minyan. And then there's an Orthodox minyan. Well, what is Schick going to do? Of course, we'll go to the Orthodox minyan because we're also in trouble. So I go to the Orthodox minyan. In the Orthodox minyan, there were about 20 males, a greater number of women, females. Of the 20 males, at least half were not wearing kippot, at least half were wearing tefillin, at least half were in davening. It was on a Monday morning, but they managed to do the davening in about 20 minutes because they circumcised most of the davening. They didn't have Kriyas Torah, they didn't have this or that, and that's the story. Let me read for you something which was published just last week from the community school in Phoenix, New Community High School. Look what it says here. Yes, our school should be bursting at the seams. Why aren't we? So they did a study, and it goes on to say, what we found was that we have an image challenge. Simply put, the majority of the families with school-aged children do not find our high school to be a community high school. Rather, they see our high school as a school for the most observant within the community. When pressed to determine why these families came to this conclusion, two common descriptors emerged. One, the requirement that boys wear kippot, and the second requirement that all the students attend tefillah during the day. So they go on to say that we discussed these two requirements, which apparently are turning away droves of parents. And what do we do? We discuss it with parents and staff and the community, whatever else, and we made two decisions, effective October 11, 2006, so it's right now. Boys are required to kippot during prayer, and during class study of religious texts. And also effective as October 1, they limit it severely. I'm not going to go because it's a very complicated formula, but they've cut down by about two-thirds mandatory tefillah. And the hope is that they'll attract more people. Let's hope they attract more people, of course, more students. But the impact on the school on the mission of the school is inevitable. So that school sending this message out is going to save North American Jewry? Of course it isn't. PEJ, the Partnership for Effective Jewish Education, whatever it's called, which is located in Boston, which does not have an Orthodox orientation, did a study 2 years ago of day schools under its ambit, if you will. And they found that there's 63 day schools in the United States, 63 that admit non-Jewish children. Now, what you're getting at here is not the question of whether it's fear or right or moral or anything else. What one is trying to get at is the question that inevitably this affects the curriculum. Inevitably, it affects what happens inside the school. Inevitably, it affects the question of religious purposelessness. Inevitably, it affects the question of religious socialization. Because you have to adjust to your student body. And in fact, as anyone would know, what you adjust very often is to a small group of students. Take a situation where it happens in schools across North America right now or throughout the world, where for orientation of teachers, before the school year begins, the principal and assistant principal may turn to a teacher of the third grade and say, in your class, you can't use the word father. You should have your father down for this event. Because there's one student in your class who doesn't have a father, either because of death or divorce or whatever, and the person's out of the picture. That happens in schools. That's proper orientation. It's the way it should be done. So you adjust not to the mass. You adjust to a small group of children. So you have 63 schools that are making that adjustment. And that 63 schools includes Orthodox schools. There was a Chabad school in South Carolina with 60 children, 15 of which were not Jewish by any definition. So what I'm saying is that what's happening outside of the school doors inevitably impacts on what happens inside the school. And what happens outside diminishes the capacity of a school to accomplish that which we want to accomplish. And that's in the non-Orthodox schools. When you go into the Orthodox schools, at least the modern Orthodox, and here I take issue with Professor Heilman very strongly, there is a profound impact of sliding to the left. Anyone who knows what's going on in these schools knows that for every student who's sliding to the right, whatever the phrase might mean, that there are children in these schools who, while they're in high school, have essentially decided to abandon the religious life. That's a fact. One shouldn't criticize the school for that. It's a fact. We know it. In fact, we know from the more accurate of the two national Jewish population surveys that Corso serves, the one of 1990. The one of 1990 showed that 79% of the students who attended a day school did not intermarry. But 21% did. Now, that survey was conducted in 1990. In 1990, since I did a study in 1992 or 3, in 1990, there were something about 1,000 or 1,200 students in non-Orthodox high schools in the United States. That's all that there were. And the number of children attending non-Orthodox schools from preschool through 12th grade was also relatively small to what the numbers are. So that 21% figure consists substantially of students who went to Orthodox schools. It's a fact. So the answer is yes. Day schools do contribute enormously to saving Jews, to Jewish continuity. But they have to want to do it. And in any case, they cannot fully exclude what's going on in the world around them. They just can't. They may like to, but they can't. And indeed, the effort to exclude does have a pernicious effect. Because in the more Orthodox schools, the admission and retention policies of yeshiva world schools, for example, in Toronto is a very good example of this. The admission and retention policies of Orthodox schools in the yeshiva world, which is a very large part of the yeshiva world, day school world, is such so as to increasingly exclude children from non-Orthodox homes for sure. They're goners. and to exclude children from marginally Orthodox homes. And, of course, we go way beyond that because you have yeshivas that exclude kids if they have television or the mother does not cover the hair or there's an internet in the house. Or in Lakewood, if a kid from the family went to a baseball game, out he goes, and the siblings go from all out the other schools. It's wrong. But it has an impact on the question of whether our schools can contribute to Jewish continuity. We don't need our schools only to contribute to the Jewish continuity of people whose families are so immersed in Judaism that serendipitously they may be lost. But in terms of the logic of the situation, they're not going to be lost. In my youth, at least, and I don't know about the youth of anyone here, we all, those of us who went to a Jewish day school, all of us had classmates who came from non-observant homes, marginally observant homes, minimally observant homes. Some of them are Rosh Yeshiva now. I wrote an article for my school newsletter saying that we've now known for a very long time that if Rabbi Akiva and Rabbi Elazar Govel, just to take two of the real giants of Jewish history, Rabbi Elazar and Gadol and Rabbi Akiva would apply to a yeshiva, they have no chance. No chance. And in fact, since there are now schools both in Israel, there are Beis Yaakovs in Israel, there's Beis Yaakovs in North America that won't accept children unless the parents are fathers in Kailo. I'm not making this up. So it comes out there a very large significant portion of the Tanoim that are Moroyim would not have been able to send their children to a Jewish school. That's a fact. And it's a wrong fact, but it has an impact on this. Because if it turns out that our schools, that is the yeshiva world schools, or the schools that have a sense of religious purposefulness, are the schools that can do the best job in contributing to Jewish continuity, then when they exclude those who might most benefit from these schools, what are they saying? That we don't want to make a contribution to Jewish continuity. Now, we're not talking here about a situation where a child, if a family says, listen, we want our kid to go there, we want to bring him, you know, we wanted to bring his chazit to school or his practices to school. We're talking about a child who will fit in. It's just that he comes from a background which is possibly growing in Judaism. Or if a child acts out, as so many children do, we now have ADD, we have a whole series of situations and pathologies and difficulties, whatever, which we hardly knew about a generation ago. Out they go. It's the easiest thing, out of sight, out of mind, the kid is lost, but we're doing a great job. Now we'll get up at the graduation, we said we have 30 graduates, there were six who got bounced out. We have 30 graduates and they're all continuing to Masifta, and they're all continuing to Kailo, they're all continuing to Beis Medrash, they're all studying in Eretz Yisrael, whatever else it would be. What's the point of it? And to add to this difficult situation, in terms of the question of whether Jewish day schools can save Judaism, in effect. The number of children attend, and this includes Chabad, the number of children attending Kiruv and immigrant schools in North America has dropped dramatically. Now, I include North America, I say North America, even though the number of Kiruv and immigrant schools that can be counted in Canada cannot... You'll have on a hand that has some fingers removed, you still have some fingers left because they don't exist in Canada. That breed of schools don't exist in Canada. They just don't. And they only exist in this city, which has enormous wealth and could have reached out to families. But there's a lot of effective outreach in Toronto. But it's not using formal chinuch, starting from the preschool up. It's just not using it. That happens to be a fact. But in the United States, there was an instinct for Kiruv schools and immigrant schools. And one after another is closing. So what does that say about the question that we ask? That says as well that certainly the schools aren't going to save. If they don't exist, they can't save. There are schools that had hundreds of children not many years ago, and they're out of business. The whole Russian scene is lost. We're now hoping that we can do something on the Bukharian scene, which is a more traditional community. And there, too, the enrollment is going down. So how do you save? What do you save? Is there anything to save? It's hard to say. I mean, it's hard to be optimistic. It's good to be optimistic in terms of what's happening in terms of the yeshiva world, whatever. And there are glorious achievements. Our community would not be the way it is. But certainly we have to do a better job. And we're not doing the job that has to be done. So can day school education save American Jewry? Well, it did save American Jewry. It's a fact. The world we're living in would have been a heck of a lot different had there not been the schools that are sometimes derided as enclavist, whatever. In my early years as president of the Rabbi Jacob Joseph School, almost all of the board members were older people who attended the yeshiva, alumni. A significant number were non-observant. And I can think of three situations immediately where people in their 80s asked to see me and crying, they said to me that, you know, I wish I would have lived an Orthodox life. I wish I would have lived a religious life, but there was no one to marry. There were no schools for girls. And so the only girls around when I was dating were people, girls who came from families that had moved away. Their children didn't go to a Jewish school. So that's an example of how a Jewish school did help save, or Jewish schools did help save, a North American Jewry. So they make a difference. There's no question about it. But you have to want it to happen. And you can't have faith. You can't have a faithless faith in schools. You simply can't say that you put up a sign in a school and saying, this is a community day school. And because we're letting Jewish kids in and we have some Jewish programming, but it's devoid of any real content. It's devoid of the Shomer. It's devoid of spirit. It's devoid of mission that we're going to accomplish something. We now know that in the 20th century, Talmud Torahs, as they were called, they're now called supplementary schools, were the handmaiden to the loss of so many, many Jewish people. Kids were going up the peak, I think, was 500,000 or more to these schools. And what did it mean? Yes, serendipitous again, some were saved, but most weren't. So what did it mean? And the fact of the matter is that particularly in the community day school section, we are witnessing the experience of the Talmud Torahs of the 21st century. Most of the community day schools have fewer hours of Jewish instruction than, let's say, the Solomon Schechter schools, the conservatives required of their own Talmud Torahs. It was part of the requirement of being a congregational school within the conservative movement that you have 8 hours of Judaics each week. That was part of the condition that you can call yourself a conservative Talmud Torah. Quite a few of the community day schools in North America do not have 8 hours of Judaics a week. And what they have is minimalistic. What they have is again, devoid of any kind of feeling about Judaism. So that is the question. And looking at and what's happening in North American schools, there are about 800 schools in the United States, and I visit at least 400 in my work. And, you know, I try to help schools. I'm responsible for programs that are aimed at providing funding and other benefits for all kinds of day schools. I don't limit my work to the Orthodox community, certainly not to the Haredi world, the Yeshiva world. In fact, most of what I do now is outside of the Haredi world. And yet, the picture that you see increasing in schools is that what's happening in the outside world is penetrating with greater ferocity than any before. So we can hope, we can pray, but essentially what we need are people who are willing to say, yes, Torah education is important, but you have to have Torah education. You can't take out the Torah. It can't be just me a meaningless phrase. If you do that, you can succeed. Thank you. Yes, ma'am. That's a very good point. It's clear that in Orthodox life, that among Orthodox families, overwhelmingly the children go to day school. I mean, it's well over 90%, so the tuition factor, which is a very potent factor, is a problem because it creates a great deal of internal stress in families that can't afford it. But it does not have that much of an impact in that part of the community yet on enrollment. There are about, in the United States, there are about 1,500 to 2,000 children who are homeschooled within the Orthodox community. It's a growing phenomenon. It hasn't been studied or written at, but about 1,500 to 2,000 students, parents, largely because of tuition factors. I'm not sending your kids to a school. As you may know, homeschooling is a large issue in the United States generally. It relates to the right-wing trend in American life where people think that public schools are giving bad values, whatever else. So that's one factor. Outside of Orthodox life, the tuition is a devastating factor, and you're definitely correct. And not only is it a devastating factor, it becomes more devastating because paradoxically you have two other things happening in the non-Orthodox schools. As you move away from, if you take again, that there's a continuum of religious life, therefore there's also a continuum of Jewish schools. So you come from the most Haredi schools to the most modern schools. As you go from the right to the left, as it will be called, tuition goes up and scholarship assistance goes down. It's a simple factor. So you have the more Haredi schools, schools in the yeshiva world, which will give scholarship assistance, even though their charges, let's say, would be $6,000 or $7,000 or $8,000 a year in many of these schools, certainly in the schools in the United States. But the schools that charge $15,000 to $20,000 a year, they don't have scholarships in their dictionary. And that's, as you're correctly saying, turning people away.
Dr. Shipp, I'd like to speak about something you said about the Kiruv and the immigrant schools. I'm a visitor this weekend from the U.S. from a school that you actually help in New York. That is a Kiruv and an immigrant school. And it also has to do with something that Dr. Heilman said. People who work in those schools get penalized from all ends. I am from the...
Penalized, you said?
Penalized, yes. I am from the more modern side. And if you're modern and you work in a modern school, you can send your children and get a tuition break in the States. If you send your kids to the same school you work in, you get a tuition break. You may send them for no tuition. You may get a tuition break. If you work in an immigrant school, Kiruv school, it's not where you're going to send your children. So you pay full tuition, which I did. I've been in my school for 22 years. At one point, I gave up my tuition, my salary for a year to pay back the tuition that I owe to my school. One of my teachers, who was Haredi, but he teaches in my school because he believes in the Kiruv movement, when his youngest child, his first daughter, came up to kindergarten, she was denied entrance to the school because her father was working with Balei Tshuva. So they did not want someone who is working with Balei Tshuva in a Kiruv school in the kindergarten of their school because of what she might bring in her wake. So it's very difficult. You sacrifice an awful lot when you end up coming in to work with the immigrant population or the Balei Tshuva population.
Yeah.
It's a very difficult field for people to give up, to come into. You give up an awful lot.
I'm not going to ask you the name of the school here.
I'll tell you afterwards.
What?
I'll tell you afterwards because you helped us. I have a big thank you for you.
Yeah, I spent a lot of time. On the first part of the question, I hear what you're saying. My sympathy is limited. You're dealing with schools. There are Kiruv schools. I'm trying to save the largest school in North America, which is called Barragola. I've spent an enormous amount of time in the last 6 months. Time, strength, and energy, I can tell you right now, I don't have. Don't have it, period. And they're in difficult shape. They spend, for their 700 children, they spend for a dual education program, obviously, and which includes a great deal of Kiruv activity. Shabbatonim, the classes after whatever and so on and so forth, they spend less than $5,000 per child. They take in $700 per child in tuition per year, largely from it's a Bukharan population, which whether wealthy or not, and there's a lot of disagreements whether the Bukharans have wealth or not. They certainly are places of wealth in the Bukharan community, but their parents won't pay tuition. So when they ask other people to pay tuition, I at least have some sympathy for the school. I have sympathy for your thing. As far as the second situation, it's definitely wrong, period.
Yeah.
Oh, sorry.
Thanks. I have a couple of questions. Firstly, on the point of the Haredi schools and the availability of funding, I would tend to disagree. I know, one thing I know about New York in particular, are many, many, many Haredi yeshivas that are not funded, except they're funded internally by themselves, and they turn away a lot of parents. And right now, there's a significant shortage within New York, for example, amongst the availability of space within these yeshivas for the demand to get into these yeshivas, which ends up with a lot of boys having to go to more marginal yeshivas, and Ashkenazim going to Sephardi yeshivas because of the availability of space. Financially, yeah. Turn away because of financial reasons. They're not part of, and they're certainly not funded by federations. There's no question about that. There's no money available at the Federation level to fund them. And I think the second point that I would make is that having served on community organizations in this city, is that the Orthodox in particular have lost the battle of being able to convince, and this is a very strong city from an educational perspective, being able to convince many of the philanthropists in the Jewish community of the importance of Jewish education. And I think if they're lost in this city, certainly in New York and the United States, they've lost that battle
Two very good points. But the fact remains that, yes, the more Haredi schools are not what they were a generation ago, even less than a generation ago on tuition, largely because they have no other funding sources. In the yeshiva world itself, the Rosh Yeshivas have sent out a message. I don't think they know they've sent out a message that ordinary basic Torah education is not something that merits community support. In my youth, almost every shul in my area would make appeals during the year for basic Torah education, a yeshiva katana or beis yakov, wherever it is. That's gone by with the wind. It doesn't exist. And other forces don't exist. So the Rosh Yeshiva send a message that kolels are important, or yeshiva gedolos are important, or as they do promiscuously, they send out hundreds and hundreds of letters a year for someone in Israel who has 18 children and 12 need heart operations, whatever else. And that kind of letters we've all seen. They don't read the letters. They don't know what goes into the letters. And they send them out. And that draws many millions of dollars, which should be going, my judgment, to Torah education. Having said that, tuition, the state of tuition is much lower in Haredi schools than in other schools. And scholarships are much more plentiful, far less plentiful than they used to be, but they exist comparable to the other schools. I mean, that's something. Second point, you're definitely right. The Orthodox have lost the battle in the Federation world, almost in the general philosophic world, just as it, although there are local places. In Baltimore, for example, last week, the Weinberg Foundation announced, together with the local fountain thing, that they're giving $3 million a year, which covers a substantial scholarship for every child in a day school, Orthodox or non-Orthodox, in Baltimore. In Columbus, Ohio, the local federation is giving $2,500 per child. In Cleveland, they're giving a lot of money per child. The Grinsman Foundation in Western Massachusetts is giving. The Samus Foundation in Seattle. So there are things happening. But remember, two-thirds of the children in day schools in North America, in the United States, are in New York and New Jersey. And that you're not seeing anything happen.
I just wanted to question your characterization of, first of all, community day schools in Toronto specifically, which is what I can speak to, and the notion that things are so dismal in the States. And I think that you really need to look at, we need to look at our own day school system and understand that, because I think it is very, very different than the picture that you painted in the States. Our federation gives $12 million a year to subsidize Jewish education out of a $60 million plus campaign, which is more than any other community in federation in North America. And that money goes specifically, or a good part of it goes specifically, to subsidize kids in the Jewish day school system. And the other point that I wanted to make is when you look at our community day schools, which would be Associated and CHAT, my kids don't go to those schools, but from what I understand, there's a very serious commitment to Torah learning. And even though all the kids that go to the schools aren't necessarily observant, the institutions themselves have a very serious and rigorous Torah education.
Thank you. Hey, the figure that you gave of $12 million out of $16 million just blows me out of the water. It just can't be. If a campaign is getting $16 million.
I'm
sorry. I stand corrected. I didn't. My hearing. $5 million goes where? Yeah. Okay.
That's an interesting point.
I will say this about Canada, and I mentioned it with respect to the conservative movement. That comparable to the United States, the non-Orthodox world, the traditional part of the non-Orthodox world, is far more along the continuum of religiosity to what we'll call the right here than it is in the United States. For example, I gave you three examples of high schools in North America and the United States, which I could have given you many more examples. So there is a difference for the United States and Canada. I think ultimately the differences will vanish, but the differences exist right now, and you're quite correct.
Hi. Just one clarification on the previous point. In 1990 here, Federation actually paid 98% of the subsidies, and today it's at about 50% of the subsidies in the system. So there about $8 million goes to subsidies out of a total school budget in Toronto of $100 million. In any event, my question, if I understand the statement of the problem, is that the outside world is really leading to a dilution of Jewish values in many of the schools. And so the solution on the Haredi side is more throwing up walls in various ways, whereas in the rest of the community, I guess my question is what you see as the solution over time to the influence of the outside world. How you see it being resolved in some positive way.
One of the things that you realize when you reach dotage, which I'm at or beyond or whatever, is that there are problems in the world that have no solution. There's an outside world which is very powerful in terms of force. It's like there's holes in the dike and there are torrents of water pouring through, and the kid tries to put his finger in this, that, and the other thing. And so generally speaking, it doesn't work. And I don't have any solution because there isn't a solution. What I think can be done in the schools that we have is to maintain a sense, as I said, of religious purposes. It's not so much who you're accepting and not so much what you're doing in this or that class, but the purpose has to be to see that these children grow in religious education, Jewish life, and being socialized as Jews. If you can do that, then you're certainly going to still suffer significant losses, but you'll accomplish a lot. But if you give up the ship and you define Judaism downward constantly in order to adjust to what's happening outside, then you're not going to save very much. Just not. That's my feeling.
First, I'd like to thank you for your kind words, which I hope that I deserve in some small part. A comment and a question. The comment is that the Hasidic schools, I think, deal very well with special needs children within their own communities, and that they take advantage in a very clever way of all the federally funded options that exist for those kinds of children. They certainly do not leave them behind, ignore them, or refuse to accept responsibility for their welfare. The question is that it seems to me that what you're saying is that community schools are kind of a blight because they really can't run with strong leadership. They're invented because of a financial problem that Balabatim have. They either have too much facilities or not enough children or too many teachers. And they hire a principal who can somehow navigate these problems, but not someone who would take over the school in his image, because that's not what the Balabatim are interested in. So perhaps the new direction that we are looking for is people who would be willing to start schools that would be open to accepting a variety of children, but would have strong leadership that would enable those children at least to get the idea that there is some kind of religious devotion possible in their world.
Three quick points. Number one, you played more than a small part. Number two, very interesting comment on the Hasidic schools. There are two interesting things that Satmar has. One is in Monroe, which is one of the two major places of Satmar. They've carved out a public school district, which has about 400 special ed kids right now. Successfully, three times the courts ruled that unconstitutional. Every time they got the New York State Legislature to redraw something and to find some loophole, and finally the lawyers and the courts gave up, so it exists, so it's funded totally by government. They have, in a public school in Williamsburg, a special education program where there's a wall built in the public, this is in the public school for Satmar kids, and as you may know, that leaving out the question over succession in Satmar between the two sons, there's a fight inside of Satmar where the group of schools that are far to the right of Satmar claiming that Satmar is sold out. And the problem of the special ed school in the public school in Williamsburg is that it's co-educational. So it's the only Satmar school anywhere which is co-educational, and that's one of the issues between whatever they are. In terms of the community schools, There still are some strong community schools. I'm simply saying the trend is in the other direction. It's powerfully in the other direction. Very powerfully. They're defining Judaism downwards. But you made an interesting point on the leadership in the school. At 8 o'clock or so tomorrow morning, I'll be in Manhattan at actually a place called the Jewish Theological Seminary and speaking, starting off the lead speaker of a conference on, they have this atrocious phrase because some people in education have done the state of headship in there. So I told the chairwoman of the conference that I'll begin by mocking the title of the conference, the state of headship, because you're not allowed to call it principals anymore because one has a school headships. But it is a crisis. And the reason why I'm speaking is I just conducted a survey of 500 principals in either non-Orthodox or modern Orthodox schools. And I sent the survey to 500. 400 responded. It's a remarkable response rate. Remarkable. And leaving out whatever things I learned, one of the things is how little tenure the principals have, how short a period of time, how they're moving from school to school, etc. So to believe under these circumstances that they can really make their presence felt in the school at Stanford is something that's not happening.
Okay. I feel that the Hasidic movement is trying to, they're fear-driven. And they're
trying
really
to what?
They're fear-driven. So what they're trying to do is maintain Judaism. Because when we see what happened with modern Orthodoxy in the States and how we've lost so many Jews, it's scary. And yet we suffer here of lack of unity. How we can do this, I know you tried to address it, but I always feel like it has to be like a grassroots kind of a thing. But I don't know what the solution is. It's scary. I'm an educator myself. And I've got 3 students now that in the public school system that have come to me from a private school system. And it's pretty amazing to see how they were handled, their special education. But I don't know how we seem to be failing here in Toronto in getting funding from the government. We've been fighting. And I don't know what the solution is. But there has to be a way of trying to educate everybody.
Unfortunately, the constitutional provisions in different places. We've worked on that. I've worked on that for most of my life. I want to deal with this issue of fear-driven. Citizen is not fear-driven. Just not. It's a mistake. Yeah, what they want to do is continue what they had in Shtetl, et cetera. They're not going to have modern Orthodox kids, non-Orthodox kids from other places enrolling there. They're not fear. They follow what there was. They believe in it. So if the Rebbe sneezed during Kriya Shema, they believe you have to sneeze during Kriya Shema. They said, the yeshiva world is fear-driven.
Okay.
The yeshiva world
is
fear-driven. Much more fear-driven than the Hasidic world. And it's one of the paradoxes of the current period. Thanks a lot.